Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, some perspective around the politics, and some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa each and every day. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, more than 1,200 people dead as the Western Cape's gang war spirals and pressure mounts on the Premier Alan Windey to stop the bloodshed. The tax rules are shifting again and the 2026 draft tax bill could reach straight into your pocket. South Africa's highest earners are also carrying the heaviest debt burden and the numbers are getting harder to ignore. And from deep fakes to fake disease outbreaks, artificial intelligence is creating a new and dangerous risk landscape right across Africa. It's Tuesday, the 25th of August. More than 1,200 murders in the Western Cape in just over 4 months. And despite soldiers and additional law enforcement on the ground, gang violence continues to terrorize communities. So what is actually going to stop the killing? It has become a very worrying situation. On the line now, Alan Windey, who is Premier of the Western Cape. Premier, a warm welcome to you. With this level of killing, do you think authorities have lost control of parts of your province?
So absolutely. I mean, we are not getting a handle on gangsterism and extortion. And of course, that's the sort of last few years, that's the added extra crime that is a driver of so many of these shootings, because the extortionists use that component of fear. And you know, this is what I've been calling for now 7 years. Is a new model of policing, because the current model is not working. We've got a new police minister. Every time I get a new police minister, I think, well, great, we're going to actually see something change. The current acting minister was appointed 1 year and 1 month ago, and you get all excited, but then nothing seems to change. And we can't keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. We now need to structurally change the way policing happens, and we need to very, very seriously really support the criminal justice system as a whole, so that we can actually have a much stronger scientific base to fighting crime, because the current system doesn't work.
Premier, you sound very frustrated in this respect. Why do you think your pleas are being ignored at national level?
So I'm not exactly sure. Initially, I think it was political. So the Western Cape is now the province that's asking for something different. I think that is now changing, because when I go to a Lekgotla with the National Cabinet, I'm getting the same comment that I make, made by the other premiers, specifically Gauteng, KZN, and Eastern Cape. And of course, between those three provinces and the Western Cape, we're the four highest murder provinces. And so absolutely, I'm super frustrated. We can't just accept it. Then we deploy the army, and that doesn't really make a difference. We make suggestions of how we think it should be managed, but it doesn't really change. And that's what's got to happen. We've got to, when you're not succeeding with what you're doing in the current model, and policing, there are new innovations that come through all the time and different innovations in different countries. Let's go and choose some of those models that are working in other countries and say, well, let's just try them here. And that's what I keep asking for.
Let's talk about that new model in just a moment, but you did reference the army. It's been supporting police through I think Operation Prosper, it's called. They've been there since April, yet by July, Premier, the police minister acknowledged not one gang had been dismantled. That operation is a failure, is it?
Yeah, I mean, this is not the first time the army's been deployed. It was deployed in 2019. And if you read all the reports of that deployment, you say, well, where did it work and where didn't it work? And that was the point of departure when the president announced it this time. I said, well, let's use those lessons. And really it was the province feels absolutely excluded when this happens. And I think the communities feel excluded as well. You've got a forced multiplier with some extra boots on the ground. That's the key difference. But, you know, it has a success rate, I think, in the beginning when that first happens, because people feel excited about it. I think that also perhaps scares maybe some of the criminals a bit. But then it doesn't take long until it's almost as if the criminals' intelligence network understands the movement of the military far better than even the police and the military system itself. And so then it doesn't seem to have any effect. So, yeah, it's the same old, same old. We keep doing the same thing and we don't learn.
In terms of those new models that you've referenced, you've been arguing for greater investigative powers for provincial and local law enforcement. But what evidence would you have that devolving those powers, Premier, would actually put more gang leaders behind bars?
So, I mean, that's a component of the overall change that I believe should happen. We should have decentralized policing powers. In other words, provinces have a concurrent power where now we only have an oversight power in the constitution. A concurrent power is, for example, like we have in education. So we have our education department. Our education department run the schools. The national government has a sort of top framework responsibility. So in our case, the national government would have to have maybe the public order police. Maybe national government would have the equivalent of an FBI, as in the US. But I don't know if we should follow that exact model. The model that I prefer is the one that's run in Germany. And so we work quite closely with the Bavarian government in Germany as one of our key partners. It is much more decentralized, federal system of policing where national is the oversight and provincial is where the decisions are made. In our case, national makes decisions, provinces just do the oversight. And each province is different. So we've got high levels of gangsterism. Much higher than other provinces. So we would have to have a different approach to policing in murders in our province, say, compared to the Free State. And that's why I believe it should change.
What one senses, though, that you might be whistling in the wind, because we also know that changing policing powers could take years. Is there anything that you can do now with the powers that you already have to stop more people being killed?
Okay, so we've done two things. The first thing is ask for a pilot project, and we said let's do that in investigative powers. And we seem to get sort of a bit of traction, and then it falls away. So we said that's why we declaring this dispute via the city, because we're showing the national minister that we do have the capacity to do those investigations, and let's just do a trial. And we said let's do a trial with the firearms that get taken off the street by our own officers. And the second component is not only asking for it, but we're actually showing it. So for the last few years, the province puts 350 million rand a year into LEAP officers in 6 hotspot areas. And you can see that it does make a difference. Of course, 1,000 LEAP officers compared to, you know, 15, 16,000 police officers is not that much. But when we concentrate those 1,000 officers in the 6 crime hotspot areas, and then you measure it, so we've actually had a decline of 29% of the accumulated target crimes, and target crimes are murder, aggravated murder, common robbery, and aggravated robbery. Across the province, we've actually had, you wouldn't believe this, but we've actually had a 15% reduction, and a 29% in the targeted areas. But I mean, you would never say that, because I mean, every day there's another shooting. And I mean, still, it's 4,000 murders in a year, and that's the problem.
Alan Windey is the Premier of the Western Cape. Premier, thank you very much. Think SARS isn't watching? Well, think again. Join MoneyWeb editor Rek van Niekerk in conversation with South African Revenue Services Commissioner Dr. Ngubane Johnson-Makubu at the Money Summit. Together, they'll unpack how SARS has transformed tax collection through AI-powered audits, third-party data matching, and tougher compliance measures. Find out what every taxpayer and business needs to know. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Centre. Register for free using the promo code MONEYWEB. Visit moneyweb.co.za and secure your seat today.
MONEYWEB at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
National Treasury and the South African Revenue Service are proposing another round of tax changes, but how much of it will actually affect the finances of ordinary South Africans? With public comment closing, I think this Friday, Sean van Sail, who is a certified financial planner at Old Mutual Personal Finance, is going to join us now to separate the important changes from the tax jargon. Always critical to do that. Sean, welcome to you. For the average taxpayer then, is there anything in these draft bills that you've seen that will materially leave them better or worse off?
Hi, Jeremy, and hi, listeners. No, there isn't anything materially impacting most South Africans. A lot of it is just slight changes to definitions of eligibility and stuff like that when it comes to medical aid tax credits. But generally, there's no concern for anyone.
When or because these are still draft laws, is there anything then, in your opinion, that people should understand before changing their financial plans in any way?
Generally, when it comes to these kind of drafts, and it's literally out for comment now at the moment for the public comment, so there isn't any concern or any need for action at this stage, because remember, anything can change between now and when the stuff gets implemented. So I wouldn't rush into making any changes. It is obviously important to bear in mind these potential changes that come up and see if it is applicable to that person. So what we would normally do is that we would reach out to whoever's helping you with your finances or your tax and just ask them, is it having any impact on their financial situation if it does come into place? And if it doesn't, then obviously there's no need to do anything. But in most cases, I wouldn't rush into making any decisions at this stage.
All right, let's work through some of the provisions then. I want to start with medical tax credits. Who actually benefits from the proposed change?
Yeah, so currently as it stands, most South Africans, you have to be belong to a medical scheme that's with the Medical Schemes Council in order to qualify for that medical tax credits. A lot of people believe that if they just pay for expenses out of their pocket that they would qualify for a rebate, but it doesn't work that way. You have to be a member of a medical scheme or paying on behalf of someone else that is a member of a medical scheme. And then you basically claim medical tax credit, not necessarily deduction. And what happens then is that medical credit is added to your thing. So you basically get a reduction in your tax, but there isn't any negative impact on that side of things.
What kind of reduction would we be looking at here?
So currently as it stands is that there isn't any... You wouldn't necessarily get a deduction for, or let's say you're contributing towards a medical scheme monthly, you would get a fixed contribution per month that you can qualify for a deduction purpose. But other than that, you basically get a credit per member on the medical scheme that you have. So if it's yourself, your spouse, and kids, you would get a number of credits per member. And then that would obviously be times by 12, and that would give you your annual medical tax credits. So as it stands now, is that you won't get with the changes that they're proposing, rather, it's not that changes will have any impact on ordinary South Africans. It's more applicable to people that are part of restricted medical schemes that aren't getting any tax benefit as at this point in time because they're in what they call restricted benefits. So for most South Africans, they won't be impacted by those changes.
Sean, Treasury, as I understand it, also wants to change the treatment of donations between spouses where one spouse is no longer a South African tax resident. Explain to me simply what problem government is trying to deal with here or close, what loophole it's trying to close.
Yeah, so currently as it stands, there's generally any donations between spouses is completely exempt from donations tax and also capital gains tax. So you could freely transfer money between the spouses. There has been this loophole where people have been using it to move money to non-resident spouses. So what they're trying to do is it's going to only affect a very small portion of the population, more your high net worth individuals or high net worth families that are doing estate planning. It will mostly affect them because of the fact that loophole that's been there is basically going to be taken away or anticipated to be taken away. So that will be meaning that anyone that's donating to a non-South African spouse resident spouse will no longer get that tax benefit in terms of avoiding donations tax, essentially.
Is there a risk that could catch legitimate families and immigrants alongside people deliberately trying to avoid tax?
It could, but I mean, I think the larger thing is that there are a lot of people that strategically do it that way to avoid tax, and then there's obviously the group that doesn't intentionally do it that way, but there will obviously be potential people that are caught in the crossfire and that they are being impacted by it when they're not supposed, or they're not actually intending to deliberately avoid tax. But again, that would be something that one would have to look at and see what are the options available to you.
Also, tighter rules, as I understand it, around secondhand goods. Sean, is this really about consumers or principally about stopping fraudulent VAT claims by dealers?
Yeah, combination of those two. So again, that's more going to be impacting your traders and obviously your consumers at the end of the day, because they might have to pay VAT on secondhand goods. But again, it's more just speculation at this stage.
And finally, the bills seek to tighten the treatment of multiple living annuities. So explain that to me. Is Treasury closing a loophole here or restricting legitimate flexibility for retirees?
I think it's more about them trying to bring clarity in the field, because there's a lot of companies that will treat things differently because they see wording in a certain way and they'll interpret it into different things. And so from that point of view, it's just to provide clarity so that essentially where some companies or some organizations might be looking at it and say that we will apply the de minimis according to all the retirement contracts that you have versus looking at across all the industry. So some look at it on a contract level and some look at it at a company level. So that's basically just bringing clarity in it, and that so that there isn't confusion where some taxpayers might be treated differently to others because they are just simply with a different product provider.
Sean Van Zyl, thank you very much indeed. You're a certified financial planner at Old Mutual Personal Finance. Appreciate your time and the explanation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you might assume that South Africa's highest earners would be best placed to handle the cost of living squeeze. Apparently not, though. There's new data from DebtBusters that shows people taking home more than 50,000 rand a month who apply for debt counselling now need an extraordinary 103% of their monthly income just to service their debt. Unsecured borrowing is soaring, payday loans are at record levels, and financial stress is hitting particularly hard at both ends of our working lives. The executive head of DebtBusters, welcome back to the program, Benai Sega. So Benai, how does someone earning more than 50,000 rand a month end up needing over 100% of their income simply to repay debt? It doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I think, Jeremy, the answer to that question is a lot of unsecured debt that is trying to make up for the shortfall in terms of the lack of income growth. I think that's the clear picture that we can see. What seems to have happened since the last pandemic ended 5 years ago, it's been a while, but electricity, petrol, inflation have really been coming at all angles. Cost of administered things, especially rates in terms of expectations, but the incomes haven't really kept up with all that pressure. And I think I would argue particularly higher income earners also tend to be entrepreneurs and so on, and they're having to probably borrow to fund, having to borrow under their personal lines to fund business activities. And I think that's the reason why you're seeing that there's a difficulty in making the numbers work.
Adding to that, Benai, so you talk about it being fundamentally a cost of living problem, and all of us are experiencing that. But is that also fair to say that higher earners, or many higher earners, are now simply borrowing beyond their means? In other words, there is a growing degree of being irresponsible.
Yeah, we always say, Jeremy, it takes two to tango. In this case, the two tangoing sides, there are lenders on one side willing to give money, and there are borrowers on the other side willing to borrow money. And these two tangoers, tango dancers, if you will, particularly since the pandemic, have really found each other in the higher income groups. And I think that's what you're seeing. It's 5 years of continuous lending and continuous borrowing by higher entire onus from the lenders in trying to make ends meet. And I think that's where we're seeing really the impact of it. That's what's really happened.
If total debt is now more than 3 times annual take-home pay, have we reached the point where this becomes mathematically unsustainable?
It does, and I think that's why we have to, of course, share that. I mean, these are consumers who have actually chosen the right thing to apply for debt counseling, so we intimately know their situation. And I would urge anyone who has a difficulty in repaying back the debt to really consider the options that they've got. It may not be debt counseling, but at some stage you have to borrow what you borrowed, you have to pay back. And I think in this case we're seeing people who are taking the responsible step to say, I have borrowed too much. I am unable to repay on the original terms that I have borrowed. Can you please help me restructure this debt and repay it back? So we are looking at a select sample, but it does become unsustainable for sure when the ratios are in the numbers that you discussed.
Bene, let's talk about the other side of that tango, if we can, the other partner, and let's reference unsecured debt again. Among the cohort that we're talking about, if I've read your numbers correctly, 84% higher than 2021. That is vastly ahead of inflation. Again, we would need to raise the question as to why lenders are still extending so much credit.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, Jeremy. We've also seen a bit move away from lenders in terms of being primarily the banks. I mean, still the 65% of the lending is happening through the banks. But, you know, if over the last 5 years, it's also changed a bit. It was 71-72%, now down to 65%. And you're seeing the gap being filled by other players in the marketplace. And I think the reason is, of course, you have all your fintechs and so on, and we have things that would probably fall under buy now, pay later type categories and larger loans. I think the lending landscape today is very different. However, every single person who is lending, will tell you the same thing, saying we are chasing quality clients who are more likely to pay us back the money that they would borrow. And guess what? I think over the last 10 years, that number of clients in South Africa has not really grown. It comes back to the growth question. So a similar pool of lending prospects are being lent more money, and that's what happens. That's where, you know, you see the serious accumulation of unsecured debt in a small number of individuals.
And that's worrying when banks and lenders concentrate too much risk in consumers who merely look affluent.
Absolutely. And I think we make this point in our report as well. There's a heavy concentration. There's a heavy risk here, you know, and you would see it's not just us, but if you also talk to some of the credit bureaus and look at their reports, they would also say that who they would deem to be good lending prospects have been suffering and to some extent showing credit loss ratios that they hadn't shown before. So there's definitely a concentration of credit risk in top income bands that hopefully as the economy starts growing, we can move away from over the next 2 to 5 years.
At the other end, lower income consumers, your data says, actually have less debt than they did. But you suggest that that's not good news. Why?
Yeah, if you look at, we have an interesting chart on the report, which I'm sure you've seen. Up until 2020, 2021, the pandemic times, the ratio of debt to income is very similar for different income bands. But since then, it's actually been trending downwards for those particularly earning less than 10,000 Rand or taking home 10,000 Rand. And the reason, and to the extent that, as you said, they've got much less debt than they did 5 years ago. And on the other end of the spectrum, highest earners is gone the opposite way. The reason for this is because what we mentioned earlier, better lending prospects for higher income earners and worse lending in terms of repay back, that's the perceived anyway. And I think this was already, before the pandemic, the trend was already going in that direction, particularly with the discussion about debt intervention and getting some unsecured debt written off. And you would remember that starting already from 2017, 2018, the lending to lower income groups has really slowed down. And now we're really seeing that almost, I wouldn't say disappear, but it's at much, much lower levels. So it doesn't, in our view, the data suggests that this is happening. So it's not that lower income groups are better at managing their debt and coming with lower debt ratios. It's just that they're being lent less money. However, the main pressure that they are feeling is coming via inflation and particularly for administered costs.
Bene Sager is executive head of Debt Busters. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Artificial intelligence is helping organizations identify risks faster and make sense of huge volumes of information, all well and good. But it's also creating a new layer of danger. Misinformation can now be produced at speed, made to look highly credible, and spread before anyone has time to verify it. For businesses and their people, that raises difficult questions about what information can still be trusted and how decisions should be made in a crisis. In the health space, this is of particular concern. And that's what I want to focus on with Dr. Chris van Straten, Global Health Advisor for Clinical Governance at International SOS. He has been on our program before. Chris, are we reaching the point where fake information itself is becoming a genuine health and security threat? Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be back on the show. And in answer to your question, I think the answer is yes.
In what respect?
Good. So I think a very good example right now is the situation we see in the DRC. And there, for example, we know that Ebola is this highly infectious disease, but it is in some ways the perfect storm in that you've had years of conflict, which has then created massive mistrust, the destruction of infrastructure. And then on top of that, you've had this mis- and disinformation. And a very good and clear example is a recent fake video of a healthcare provider talking about what one would call alternate or fake treatments, and that Ebola is a scam, kind of a Western plot, if you will. And the net result of that is, I'm afraid, is that a treatment center was attacked, healthcare professionals were killed, and I'm afraid more people were exposed and then died. So that is a catastrophic event triggered by fake and false information. And the same is true in the security space. And for big companies navigating, working in Africa, the DRC, or neighboring countries, having real intel and meaningful intel and what to do with that intel is critically important.
Chris, in fact, you go on to describe AI-generated deep fakes of health professionals as, and I quote, a new frontier of bio-warfare. Are you being deliberately provocative, or do you genuinely believe that misinformation can cause harm at that scale?
Oof, it's a good one. I would sort of nudge towards being provocative, but that being said, if you look at some of the global health threats, and some of which we've either eradicated or brought mostly under control, now resurfacing in many parts of the world, including the developed world, because of continued dis- and misinformation about certain types of vaccination, the damage is very real. And it's often for young children and or families. And the repercussions of that will be bigger, also economically. So it's a difficult one. One doesn't want to be overly dramatic, but I'm afraid there are bad players in this space, whether it's hacking and cybercrime and trying to leverage that with large companies and or causing misinformation distrust. It is real. It is there.
The genie, of course, is out of the bottle. Around 60% of organizations say AI's greatest value is verifying information. But Chris, if AI is also generating the misinformation, obviously we're using the same technology to police the problem it created. And your contention is that can have catastrophic effects, particularly in the sector within which you work.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And yes, it can. Now, a caveat to that one, we do use very sophisticated AI tools, and we have partners that have helped us build and develop these tools, A, in the security space, but also medical space that we're working. But what's become very evident is these tools are really good at gathering data, helping us work through huge reams of data really quickly. But when it still comes to the decision to deploy, not to deploy, how to protect a facility, how to protect that facility, what we're seeing is really the hand, boots on the ground, human intel, connection with the ministries of health, and the different stakeholders remains critically important in driving success.
You referenced at the start of our conversation the DRC and Ebola. Chris, on the continent, information, as we well know, is fragmented across local media, WhatsApp groups, I guess, governments and community networks. Are you concerned that the continent is perhaps more vulnerable to convincing misinformation than other parts of the world?
I am, Jeremy. Yep, that's a very good question. And there's many layers to that. One of the layers was referenced in an article I was reading this last week, where it speaks about how many AI models were built in the developed world and built around certain language and cultures. Not many have actually been geared towards African cultures, African languages. There's a definite gap there. And then also the oversight and or governance that is, in many instances, not even in place around digital tools and how it should work.
So if a convincing deepfake appears tomorrow, Chris, announcing a disease outbreak or maybe an airport closure or some kind of security emergency, given the warning that you've just sounded, what are the things that an organization needs to do before acting on it?
Okay, great. Well, I really do hope most big companies and their duty of care and their risk managers, whether it's on the health security side, should already have well-structured policies and procedures in place. But more than that, especially now around the AI space, the more mature companies have already developed protocols for how do we look at this data, where do we use the AI, and at what point do we then engage with the security or data analyst to then say, right, this does appear to be fake. And the reason we say it's fake is multiple sources, A, on the ground, and our own intel and connections are reinforcing that this signal is a signal that we will call fake at this point. What's interesting, these surveys are done annually. This is a sort of a pulse check. It's still interesting to see how many companies are, from just the pandemic perspective, still seem to be lagging. And from an AI perspective, really it's early days. And I think many companies would be well placed to take this on and either partner with companies that are doing it, because we're not the only ones in the space. And increasingly, it's a good thing to navigate.
Well, to that point, if I've read your data correctly, it shows that only 10% of organizations believe they can respond quickly to emerging and real threats. Again, I guess we've got to ask the question why companies are still so slow when misinformation, as you've outlined to us, can spread globally. I was going to say within minutes, but it's even less than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's seconds, especially with social media and the different tools we have and the very tools you and I now are using to communicate. So yes, it can. It's phenomenal. I think back to my grandfather's generation. He was also a doctor and a professor and was helping with research in infectious diseases. And there, the big fear was always things like malaria or cholera or Ebola when it first emerged back in 1976. And that was the big fear, these things that could move quickly, or a big flood that would come every decade or something. But misinformation travels at a speed that is actually, it's beyond our compute, actually, and also the scale of it, the fact that millions of people can get that information and potentially act on it within seconds and minutes really does mean we have to build in sensible governance checks and keep the human in the loop.
Dr. Chris von Straaten, as always, thank you very much indeed. You are Global Health Advisor for Clinical Governance at International SOS. And on that note, we are going to end today's program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.